Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Eldon Taylor as we talk about, I believe, very strong points here. We'll take your calls, and I'd love for you to share your stories with us when we come right back. Welcome back, Eldon Taylor with us. Eldon, in your book, one of the chapters, The Value of Mortality. Now, what did you mean by that? How could mortality be valuable?
You know, to me, that one, that stands out as just an obvious factor that we really don't give any thought to. Imagine that I live for forever. And so there was, as a result, nothing that I could do that would have any consequence today, because tomorrow I could do something else. There was never, if you will, there was never a payday to what my activities were, and never a day in which I had to pay my bills. With that kind of a life in front of you, what you would end up doing is failing to appreciate every minute, every moment that you currently have. You not only fail to appreciate it, but you would live a life that was devoid of any real meaning. You know, we have kind of a value system that I've watched evolve in the last 25, 30 years in our country. It has to do with this nature of disposable. You know, we have disposable lighters. Now we're getting disposable cell phones. We have more and more disposable this, that, and the other, versus a society in the past where you took very good care of things. You made them last well beyond what, you know, their expectation was.
I remember my mother, Eldon, had one of those old Maytag washing machines, you know, with the rollers on there.
Yeah, the ring washers.
Yeah, that thing lasted forever.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of things continue to last forever if we take care of them, but we don't plan to keep them forever. There's something newer, later, greater, you know, with some new technologies coming, and we know that, and so we buy into this whole disposable bit. You know, we don't take bottles back to the grocery store that had our soda pop in it. We throw cans away and plastic away. It's an entirely different mentality. Well, if we live forever, we would have that same kind of mentality about the quality every single day has. You know, if you read the Tao Te Ching, the Tao, my favorite chapter in there begins this way. There are 30 spokes on the hub, or on the wheel. Now, if you examine that chapter, what it talks about is the 30 spokes on a wheel, that what we would see would be the positive. We would see the spokes, we would see the outer part of the wheel, we may see a metal band around that wheel. We will not see the holes in the hub. We could see a clay pot, and we would notice maybe the kind of clay or the shape of the pot or the color of the glaze, but we don't pay attention to the hollow in the pot. We look at a home and we see a roof, we see walls, we see doors, we see windows, but we don't see the space in the rooms. Now, part of the perception problem you alluded to earlier in the first hour, part of that perception trap is the way we see things. A pot has no value without the hollow in it. The wheel means absolutely nothing without the holes in the hub so that I can mount it on a wagon and make the wheel work. And a home, what is a home if it doesn't have space in the rooms?
And people and love.
Well, that's right. But it is our perception. And so when you think about mortality, knowing that, however I see my life, it will end, and maybe as Christopher Hitchens says, that's it. And maybe as I personally believe, it's not. You're going to cross over into a different dimension. Whatever that result is, knowing that it's coming, I have my life to look at from a standpoint of what is its purpose, what am I here for, how can I enrich its quality, and where is it I want to be when that moment comes? What feelings, what thoughts do I want to have? Do I want to be able to say to myself, my life made a difference. I did my very best to help as many people as I could, whether it's my family or it's a larger environment. You know, one of the things that I really learned, George, and in part the universe teaches me these things. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm going to digress just a little bit. I had a young woman that was sent to me once, referred by a psychiatrist, who was suicidal, seriously clinically depressed.
Yeah.
At the same time, she had a whole history of self-mutilation. And I looked at her intake sheets, her medical intake sheets, before I saw her, and I saw that the first therapist that saw her was a man by the name of Milton Erickson. Now, Milton Erickson is the father of NLP. He's the father of a lot of hypnotherapy. To me, he walks on water. And when I saw that, you know, the thought that occurred to me was, if he couldn't help her, what on earth am I going to do? I honestly was without resources at that moment. For a moment, I have no clue what to do here. And then the universe served up. You can call it inspiration. A thought came to me. And yeah, I will do that. And what I did is I explained to her that I would see her for 10 weeks, that's all, in a brief therapy. But she would have homework, and she would do this homework religiously, or I wasn't going to see her, because if she didn't want to change, there was no sense in us pursuing this route. So she agreed to that, and her homework was simple. That first week, she had to do one good deed for someone else every single day. And then she had to get a new journal, make one, buy one, and put it by the bed so that every night when she went to bed, she would write down that good deed. And then she would write down how she thought it made the person feel that she did it for. And then she would write down how it made her feel. Close the diary, close the journal, close her eyes, and go to sleep. That was how she was to go to sleep every night. Week two, it was two. Week three, it was three good deeds every day. We got it up to five, but she didn't always do five. But she did at least the three every single day. Now, what happened over that 10-week period was that as she recorded these things, as she did them, and at first some of them were lame, but then some were really pronounced, she began to realize that her life made a difference, that there was value to her, that this value was what she'd always been searching for. Listen, when somebody is suicidal, it's because they feel valueless. They don't deserve to live. You know, they need to be put out of their misery. When that value was filled from the inside, when this woman discovered that her life could make a difference, and it was helping other human beings, everything changed. Well, and I followed this woman, and she eventually was off of all pharmacology, and at the same time no longer clinically depressed, and this old behavior pattern was completely aborted, and all due to one simple thing. Instead of her thinking about what she was getting out of life, she was focused on what she was giving. And in that process, she was filling herself up. Well, you know, I call this the warm, fuzzy feeling. And when I put my head on the pillow for the last time, or however it ends, I want to think that my life has made a difference, that somehow, some way, I've been able to help other human beings. Now, I've shared this with lots of people in lots of different walks of life, and I can tell you this. Whether you're a plumber, you're listening out there, a truck driver, you're an attorney, you're a physician, you're a surgeon, it matters not. If you see your job as helping other human beings, you're the plumber. You're not going out there to fix a leak in a pipe. You're going out there to solve a problem for someone on the other end who needs your help. When you take that attitude in what you do, two things happen. The first one is you get a great deal more satisfaction out of what you do. And the second one is, somehow magically, you know, your business gets better, people like you more, life seems better, everything changes. And to me, these kinds of things would not be appreciated at all, but for the fact we know the race doesn't last forever.
Good point. Elton, let's take some calls. Elton John is with us. Wayne is in Tacoma, Washington, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Wayne.
George and Elton, how are you guys doing tonight?
Good, Wayne. Thank you.
Hey, three things that have made a great importance in spirituality in my life. First of all, mother. Raised in the church. I went to church in my mother's belly. Heard those sermons from that time on and grew up in the church and got a lot from the teachings of the Sunday school teachers on that. Secondly, the radio. In the home with the old tube radio, listening to the preachers when I was a baby in the crib. I can remember a preacher who's still on the radio, J. Vernon McGee, through the Bible radio. He's been on the radio for over 70 years now. Wow. They claim he has a listening audience of over 100 million people every night in China alone. That's amazing. He's got a program called, like I say, Through the Bible Radio. It takes 5 years to go through the Bible. And he's on the eighth time of doing this on the radio. And lastly, when I was just getting out of the Air Force, I felt God's call on my life. I was in the hospital in the Air Force, read my New Testament through, and felt God speaking to me. Came back home to Olympia, Washington, asked a friend to go to the mountains with me to pray and seek God. My friend skipped out on me. I went to the mountains alone that night. All night long, there was goats circling all around me, keeping me awake all night long. I don't know if they were protecting me from the wild animals or what. The next morning, I stumbled down the mountain, got into my car, got down to the road, started driving, and as soon as I got on the smooth road, I started veering off. And fortunately, that was the first year they had the little bumps in the middle of the road, and I started bump, bump, bump. Right. And all I had time to say was, Jesus, help me. And within a minute, less than a minute, there were two men on the road. And I picked those men up. And I drove into Olympia, Washington with those men, another 30-40 miles, and dropped them off, not in town, but not at a side stop, but right in the middle of the road. And I dropped them off where it was all clear, plain to see, looked out on the road for other cars to come, went back out on the road, looked back to wave goodbye, and they weren't there anymore.
Oh, wow. You know, George, that and Wayne, that reminds me of you and I, George, one evening were having a conversation about miracles. And this is a couple of years ago. And, you know, I got a text message from one, or an email, I should say, from one of the listeners, mm-hmm. and I still remember this. She said, I heard you tell your train story, and I have to tell you this story. And I've got her permission to since reuse the story, and I have a couple of times. But yeah. There was a family in an automobile one night when it was raining very heavily, and the automobile was traveling a bit too fast. And as it came around a corner, the driver lost control, the father lost control, and the car went off the cliff, killed everybody in it. But there was a young boy, 6 years old, and that young boy went to the neighbor's house and asked for help. And when law enforcement got there, they asked him, how did you get out of the car? Because the car was obviously going very fast. And he said, a giant hand reached in and picked me out and set me down.
So we get those stories all the time, Elton, don't we?
Yeah. And you know, when you have those, Wayne, you have to know there's a spiritual connection going on, and it makes all the difference in the world in your life, doesn't it?
Sure does. Lucy in Modesto, California. Hi, Lucy. Go ahead.
Hello. How are you?
Good, Lucy.
I just wanted to share a simultaneous event that was happening here. I often do two things at one time, and I was listening to your program, taking notes on Mr. Taylor and his speaking. And at the same time, I was reading an excerpt from the great books a period written in 1650-51 by, interesting enough, Jeremy Taylor. And I kept getting this feeling that the author was talking to me. And it was so funny because what I was reading was running parallel to a lot of things that he was saying. And this Jeremy Taylor has written The Rule and Exercises of Holy Living and The Rule and Exercises of Holy Dying in 1650 and 1651. And anyway, I just think it would really be worthwhile for Mr. Taylor to check it out.
Thank you very much. I'll do that. I've got a Wikipedia page up on Jeremy Taylor right now, and I'll be acquiring his books. You can count on that.
And no relation, huh?
No, well, not that I know of, but, you know, maybe I have to do that DNA deal that you were explaining. You know, that sounds pretty interesting.
It is. It really is. And they keep it very confidential. They use it with numbers, Eldon, not names.
Yeah. Well, so. I'll definitely get in and look at that. But, you know, the caller, Lucy, reminded me of something that I think is important to get expressed, if I may, George. Well, I see you're actually coming up on a break, a hard break.
That's so. Okay. We got a couple minutes. Go ahead.
Well, this one may take more than a couple minutes, but I'll talk really fast. 2 weeks ago, I was in a CEU course all day long. It was a neuroscience course. It was facilitated by a neuroscientist who herself had carried out many of the studies that we looked at, Kateri McRae of the University of Denver. And all day long, we looked at one study after another study after another study, all empirical data, and there were two take-homes from this. The first one was, you absolutely can change. You know, whatever your belief is out there in the world, you absolutely can change. When I went to school, I was taught IQ is fixed, personality becomes fixed at, you know, 4 to 6 years of age, brain cells die when you're 30 or so, and they're not replaced, and so forth. DNA is hardwired. Well, all of that is false to fact. The hard data shows not only can you change all of those things, but you can actually add gray matter to your brain, okay? You can change the physiology of your brain. But the second takeaway was the really important one, I think, to this time that you and I are spending together, and that's this. You can only change what you believe you can change. If you're fixed in your mindedness, you already have everything all worked out, you know how it is, et cetera, well, then I hope you walk on water, because if you don't, you're denying yourself the process that's involved. When you do allow that, you can make these changes. You can realize a higher, greater self. I don't know who this guy Jeremy Taylor is. I'm certainly going to check that out. But what I thought of when Lucy was talking about the great books was this great work that neuroscience is doing today, showing us just how much potential rests in our beliefs.
Let's talk about the brain with the belief system and final calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Don Derry joins us. We're going to talk about ET abductions, so make sure you're part of that story. He's a retired psychology professor. And when we come back in a moment with Eldon Taylor, we'll take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Now, welcome back, Eldon Taylor with us. We'll take your final phone calls here. Eldon, in terms of belief systems, what do people do to change, to get into that mode?
Well, you know, the very first thing that we have to recognize is what it is that we believe. And I think, you know, the best way to do that is like we breathe. We do it one thought at a time. It's easy to see all the beliefs we have as being just so many and so encumbered and so involved in defense strategies and unconscious processes that, what on earth, how could I possibly ever do that? And the way to just see it is, look, I don't know how many years any of us have, but if you start thinking about every single breath that you have, and you start then calculating how many breaths you're going to have, oh, say, over the next 20 years, well, the number becomes astronomical. Our thoughts are like breath. You know, our mind is constantly chattering,
And that stream of consciousness is telling us what we truly believe. You know, harken back to the millionaire. I want to be a millionaire, but my stream of consciousness is saying, what are you going to do, rob a bank? Well, everything that happens in my life, you know, I'm going along and somebody cuts me off in 5 o'clock traffic. I get all upset about that. Why am I getting upset? It's time to question what I'm getting upset over. What is it? This space was my space and he just took my space? Do I made me put my brakes on? I mean, what is it that I'm frustrated about? Where did the belief come from? That's the important thing. If we have the time, as we discover each of these beliefs, there are some things that we should do. We can take notes. We can write down what the belief was. Or we can write down what the thought was, and then later go back and attempt to discover that belief. Why is it that we think, we don't deserve? Why is it, where did the thought come from that I'm not attractive? Why is it that we get upset at our spouse or our children? All of these things enter our mind on a continual basis as this stream of consciousness. Now, when we get that aberrant thought, it's time for us to say something. You know, and for me, and I've seen this work over and over, as silly as it may sound, you just simply say, cancel, cancel, cancel. I don't want that one. I'm going to rewrite that one. Because, again, think back to the nucleus accumbens making all these decisions for us, 90% out of our conscious range. And then, you know, the other 10%, the 10% you think you're in charge of, well, you're really not in charge of that 10% either. Let me tell you how that works. There's a wonderful story that Professor King tells. He's a psychologist. He's an expert on addiction. And because he's an expert on addiction, he noticed he was a couple of hundred pounds overweight and decided he was going to lose some weight. Now, the way he's going to do that, to begin with, he's just going to drop Krispy Kreme donuts because he loves those doggone things, and he eats a dozen or more every single day. And he's just moved to a new community, and where he lives, the nearest Krispy Kreme is 5 miles away, and he has to get on the freeway to get to it. So he just won't get on the freeway. He just won't have Krispy Kreme. Well, that's fine. It works for a couple of months, and then he has to go out of town. He's on the freeway. The minute he gets on the freeway, Krispy Kreme donuts. And he starts this dialogue. He tells the dialogue like this. You know, he says to himself, oh, Krispy Kreme, I've been really good. I could stop and get a donut there. No, you won't have one donut. You know that. You'll have more than one. Well, I was going to get a cup of coffee anyway. I can just stop and get a cup of coffee. You know yourself better than that. You're not going to just get a cup of coffee. You'll also get a donut. Well, I don't see that one donut would be that much of a problem. Again, you won't just get a donut. You know yourself. You're going to have several donuts. And this dialogue continued, him talking to himself until he realized he had exited the freeway and was pulling in the parking lot of Krispy Kreme donuts. Now, you know, I think everybody out there can relate to that kind of a dialogue that goes on this other 10%. We're telling ourselves, well, no, I'm not going to have that chocolate. I'm on a diet. Or you know, yeah, I'm going to do the exercise, but I really don't have time tonight. I'll try that again tomorrow. We have these conversations. That's the 10% that we think we're in charge of. And you can see that we're really not in charge of even that 10%. So if you understand that in an analogical sense, that subconscious mind of yours is a biocomputer. And as a biocomputer, that old GIGO that programmers used to use, garbage in, garbage out,
yep,
definitely applies. Now, add to that what I call ants, automatic negative thoughts, and you can see that these automatic negative thoughts that come along, and every time we want to move out of our boundaries, hey, that's for me. I should try that. I'd enjoy that. Every time there's an opportunity, and then we say to ourselves, that's when we have these ants climbing around as a result of this garbage in, garbage out. And the only remedy for that is to change what's in the unconscious. If we're going to have free will, and you and I have discussed this one before, if you're going to have free will, you're going to have to be at least in charge of the computer that is calculating what it is that you're going to do, that those MRI technicians are seeing you decide before you ever know what you've decided. And that means I have to monitor this stream of consciousness, and I have to work to change those thoughts and those beliefs. Now, there are several ways that I explain in the book as to how you can do this in addition, but that's the first step, George.
Okay. To the calls we go. Lakewood, Ohio. Jim's with us. East of the Rockies. Jim, good morning.
Yes. Hi, George. Eldon, one of the things you were talking about you know, the people in traffic and things like that, Nelson Mandela once said, you know, that if you hold a resentment against somebody, that it's like drinking poison, and you're drinking the poison to kill your enemy. So all you're going to do is have this negative stuff that's messing you up. But anyway, the thing about atheists, which interests me, Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller, he's written books, you know, about him being an atheist. And what is it about it when I see somebody like that that I have admired in the past, and now he says he's an atheist, and it makes me think, like, well, now he's not as good as an entertainer, because I go, my wife and I are both very spiritual and things like that, but, you know, you see somebody like that you admire, and that happens. The other thing about lying that you mentioned before, too, is in court, you know, tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Look at all those bases they're trying to cover. Tell the truth. Don't lie to, you know, a question. And then tell the whole, you know, tell the whole truth. The second one is like, you know, like, oh, let's see, Joey kicked his brother in the leg, but he goes, not really, my shoe hit him, my foot didn't. You know, and then nothing but the truth, don't add a lie to it, you know, and then, but anyway, the last thing, and this is very important, I lost a son to testicular cancer, and I'll never forget this, when we had that god-awful roundtable discussion one, and we got to say, you know, we got to let him go. The head of the cancer clinic at the Cleveland Clinic, the one thing I'll never forget, he said, the one thing I dislike about the Cleveland Clinic is we can keep somebody alive forever. And in other words, he was trying to tell me, as the father, we could let him go, but it's got to be up to you. Well, you know what? Maybe we let him go, and we had to, but I think about him every day, and it's not that my beliefs got any less. They actually got stronger. I talk to my son every day as a father,
sure.
And I just wanted to let you know that.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you very much. I mean, and you know, if you cannot think of your son as being there where you can talk to him, the chasm that's created by that loss is just, there's so much sorrow that would swell up in there that it would almost be difficult to continue to live. Your spiritual belief carries you a long way when it comes to those things. But Jim, when you talk about traffic and you talk about drinking the poison, then you turn right around and you point to the atheist and you feel like he's less. You just drank a little of that poison yourself. So, you know, it's a natural thing for us to elevate our own beliefs. And as I pointed out in the first hour, we want to hear what we want to hear. We want people to agree with us. We really don't like to entertain ideas or thoughts that are incompatible with what our beliefs are. You know, I can only tell you from my own experience here with respect to this, but, you know, there are some really great minds that have been atheists, and there are some great minds that are theists. I don't understand myself how someone like Christopher Hitchens, with his brilliance, could indeed be an atheist. But, you know, I can't hold any enmity toward him. I admire his brilliance. I love his writings. He inspires me with how he uses words. And I think it is the charge of all of us to see the strength and the qualities in everyone. And whether we agree or we disagree with them, that shouldn't subtract from them at all or from ourselves. You have that prerogative and they have that prerogative, and we should be able to sit down and have conversations and even exchange hugs, recognizing that each of us has the absolute right, indeed the prerogative, to believe as we need to believe, and even if that belief is, you know, for all intent and purposes, self-sabotaging, and that individual is not interested in hearing otherwise, we have no right to subtract from them. What we do should be to give to them, and if we do, I'm convinced in time they'll open up, and you know, you'll have that opportunity to share at that level. I hope that makes some sense, Jim. I really appreciate your call. I'm truly, truly sorry to hear about your son.
In Jacksonville, Florida, Paul's turn on the wild card line. Paul, you're on with Eldon Taylor.
All right. Hey, George, appreciate you accepting the call. Mr. Taylor, great show, man. Yeah, I really got a lot from what you've been saying tonight. And, of course, hearing everybody, I want to change it up a little bit. Anyway, as far as belief system, all my life I have felt like no matter what happened to me, I could always bring myself up, and that's because of God. I've always had a God in my life, although I hadn't lived godly a whole lot of time, but he's always been there regardless because he loves us regardless, and that is my belief system. Although I do try to repent daily as I can. But anyway, back to a job is what I'm actually going at. I've had like 10 different jobs my whole life, and every time I've always thought God's going to take care of me and I will get a better job than I had before. And that has always gone with me. I'm 53 now. And my last job, which was about 2 years ago, I was let go. And actually, for the first time, I had no remorse, no upset or anything, totally calm, like somebody just handed me $100,000. 2 weeks later, I'm now on the best job of my life, making more money than I ever did before.
How fantastic.
So that is in there. Now, as far as this atheist thing, I've always wanted to say this, George, and I wanted to get on the line and say it. Back when I was 19 years old, I had been with God all my life, like the man talked before, in the mother's belly, in church and all. But I had to have proof. And now that this has happened to me, I look back and I see I had a lot of proof. But at one point, I got so emotionally out of whack, I was sitting on a dam and really didn't, I was about suicide mode. I was extremely lonely, just went through a total meltdown. And what I did on that dam was drink 3 cases of beer and tried to drink myself to death on that dam. And out of that, I made the decision to be part in the Bible where it says, invite the devil in, don't ever invite the devil to you. I remembered that verse and I said that, but remember I was in dire straits and trying to kill myself. And that night I went to bed and I was woken up with the deepest fear I've ever had in my life. Like I was a child and there was something in the closet. There was something at the foot of my bed. I didn't see it. I had the covers over my head, but I was so scared, petrified that I could not move. Seconds after that, I rose up in the bed and there was a super bright light behind me and I was totally calm. My mind was empty. I had no thoughts, just total peace and well-being about myself. And then after that, it quit. So, and then I woke up the next morning. I thought, what the heck was that? And I think what it was, the devil was there as I asked him to be. The Lord came in and knew me and gave me a choice. And I made that choice to live a better life at that time.
Miracles do happen, don't they, Paul? Miracles do happen.
It's about choices, too, and you've got to make the right ones.
Yeah, and about, you know, those latent beliefs. But, you know, I'm reminded back in those days that I told you about when I was, you know, jaded and I was trying to turn a corner. I'd become aware and, you know, we'd run these studies and I was trying to become this better human being. And one of the teachers that I worked with, a woman that was a metaphysical teacher, I happened to be, you know, having this conversation with her. And she said, Eldon, look, you know, just shift your perspective a little and understand that everything that comes to you comes for some ultimate good. You know, I mean, it, even if it doesn't, just having that attitude will make things better for you. So, okay, I'll try that, Dorothy. So I left her place, and I went back to my office, and as I pulled into
to my offices. They were in a strip mall at the time. I had to pass this restaurant that was right out in the front of this horseshoe-shaped strip mall. And as I passed it, a car backed out right into the side of my new Cadillac.
Oh, gosh, I hate that. Ugh.
Now, you know, I'm sitting there, and because I just left Dorothy's, I said, you know, I cannot wait to see what good comes from this. I got out of the car, and the guy driving this other car, an older gentleman, was furious with me. He's wagging his finger, accusing me of hiding my car behind his old car so he could run into it. Now, it happened that there were two law enforcement officers coming out of the restaurant that saw the whole thing. Well, I ended up sitting in a car with one officer, and we were laughing about this guy and his attitude that I hid my car behind his car so he could run into my brand new Cadillac. If I hadn't have had that attitude, I can't wait to see what good comes from this. I don't know what I'd have done. You know, I probably got out of the car upset because it was a new car. And, you know, with his attitude, who knows where it would have gone. One thing's for sure. I look back on that now, and I laugh. I think of it as a real turning point in my own life in realizing that it's just a shift in your belief. It's just a little shift in your perception that makes all the difference to the outcome and how you handle the things life brings to you.
It is critical. Eldon, would you please tell us where we can get this new book, I Believe?
Oh, sure. And you know, listen, I have to tell everybody out there, if you go to my website, eldontaylor.com, there's a large banner. The book is pictured there. You click on that banner, it will open up and tell you about literally $10,000 worth of gifts and prizes that you get when you buy this book. You don't buy the book from me. You get the book from Barnes & Noble or Amazon or Books A Million. But you bring back your receipt and you put it in. And there are all kinds of luminaries, people that want you to understand how important your belief is that are making gifts available there. So be sure and go to eldontaylor.com and click on that banner. George, I love you. I love everything you do. Thank you so much.
You got it. Eldon Taylor. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, John B. Wellesley, and Pundit and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.